Welcome. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, July 31st, 2025, we talk about myeloma, mitochondrial DNA disease, cardiac surgery, and squamous cell carcinoma. A review article on motor vehicle crash prevention. A case report of a woman with seizure-like activity and odd behaviors. A Medicine and Society article on the evaluation of occupational pulmonary impairment, and perspectives on COVID-19 vaccines, on public policies, and on living on the edge of the valley of the sick. Measurable residual disease-guided therapy in newly diagnosed myeloma, by Aurore Perrault, from the Hôpital Universitaire de Toulouse Oncopole, Toulouse, France, and co-authors. This Phase 3 clinical trial studied how to best continue treatment in patients with newly diagnosed multiple myeloma after initial therapy. All participants first received a combination of four drugs: isatuximab, carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. Based on how much cancer remained, measured by a sensitive test for measurable residual disease, MRD, patients were divided into four groups. Patients who had no detectable cancer, MRD negative, were given either a stem cell transplant, ASCT, plus two more drug cycles, or just continued with six more drug cycles. Patients who still had detectable cancer, MRD positive, received either one or two stem cell transplants. The study found that patients who were already MRD negative did just as well with continued drug treatment as with a transplant. Similarly, patients with remaining disease saw no added benefit from having two transplants instead of one. These results suggest that MRD testing may help guide more personalized, less intensive treatment choices. Paul Richardson from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Boston, and co-authors write in an editorial that it will be important to assess whether the findings by Perrault and co-authors regarding MRD negative response are borne out by long-term survival outcomes. It will also be important to assess the competing risks of secondary hematologic cancer and infection during long-term immunosuppression with regard to their effect on survival. One size clearly does not fit all regarding patients with newly diagnosed myeloma. It will therefore be vital to determine which patients derive specific benefit from high-dose melphalan ASCT and which patients do not need this treatment. Assessment of a patient's MRD status alone may not be sufficient for treatment decision-making. However, MRD status combined with genomic risk stratification and other clinical features could provide a powerful approach to real-time tailoring of treatment that would enable us to determine how much treatment is truly enough to maximize benefit in our patients. Mitochondrial donation and pre-implantation genetic testing for mtDNA disease, by Louise Hislop, from the Newcastle Fertility Center, Newcastle upon Tyne, United Kingdom, and co-authors. Children born to women who carry pathogenic variants in mitochondrial DNA, mtDNA, are at risk for a range of clinical syndromes collectively known as mtDNA disease. Mitochondrial donation by pronuclear transfer involves transplantation of nuclear genome from a fertilized egg from the affected woman to an enucleated fertilized egg donated by an unaffected woman. Thus, pronuclear transfer offers affected women the potential to have a genetically related child with a reduced risk of mtDNA disease. These authors offered mitochondrial donation by pronuclear transfer or pre-implantation genetic testing to a series of women with pathogenic mtDNA variants who sought to reduce the transmission of these variants to their children. The investigators found that mitochondrial donation through pronuclear transfer was compatible with human embryo viability. The integrated program involving pronuclear transfer and pre-implantation genetic testing was effective in reducing the transmission of homoplasmic and heteroplasmic pathogenic mtDNA variants. Mitochondrial donation in a reproductive care pathway for mtDNA disease by Robert McFarland from Newcastle University, Newcastle upon Tyne, United Kingdom, and co-authors. Pathogenic variants in mitochondrial DNA are a common cause of severe, often fatal, inherited metabolic disease. In this study, a reproductive care pathway was implemented to provide women carrying pathogenic mtDNA variants with reproductive options. A total of 22 women with pathogenic mtDNA variants have commenced or completed pronuclear transfer and thus receipt of a mitochondrial donation, and there have been 8 live births. All 8 children were healthy at birth, with no or low levels of mtDNA heteroplasmy in blood. Hyperlipidemia and cardiac arrhythmia developed in a child whose mother had hyperlipidemia during pregnancy. The child's 2 conditions responded to treatment. Infant myoclonic epilepsy developed in another child with spontaneous remission. At the time of this report, all the children have had normal developmental progress. Robin Lovell Badge from the Francis Crick Institute, London, writes in an editorial that a total of 18 live births occurred after pre-implantation genetic testing, each with a sufficiently low proportion of the pathogenic mtDNA to confirm that this approach remains a valid risk reduction method. The fact that 8 apparently healthy babies were born after pronuclear transfer, without which mitochondrial disease would have developed in these babies, is a clear demonstration of the usefulness of this method for women for whom pre-implantation genetic testing is not an option. The Newcastle group has not only implemented mitochondrial donation as an option for women with mitochondrial disease, they also designed and implemented an entire program of clinical care to address mitochondrial disease in the context of reproduction, where patients are offered options that minimize risks and provide the best likelihood for them to have a healthy child. In a Science Behind the Study editorial, Julie Stefan from the Paris Cité University writes that the studies described by Hislop et al. And McFarland et al. Were rigorously conducted and involved long-term monitoring. The study represents a critical step toward a reconsideration of the numerous regulatory and ethical barriers against the clinical implementation of mitochondrial replacement therapy in many countries, including the United States and France, where it was ruled in 2023 that mitochondrial replacement therapy embryos are transgenic, that is, with genetic modification of the germline lineage, and hence prohibited. Indeed, the results reported by Hislop et al. And McFarland et al., although early, support the hypothesis that mitochondrial replacement therapy can prevent the transmission of mtDNA disease. A randomized trial of acute normovolemic hemodilution in cardiac surgery by Fabrizio Monaco from the IRCCS San Raffaele Scientific Institute, Milan, Italy, and co-authors. Patients undergoing cardiac surgery often receive red blood cell, RBC, transfusions, along with the associated risks and costs. Early intraoperative normovolemic hemodilution, that is, acute normovolemic hemodilution, is a blood conservation technique that entails autologous blood collection before initiation of cardiopulmonary bypass and reinfusion of the collected blood after bypass weaning. More data have been needed on whether acute normovolemic hemodilution reduces the number of patients who would receive allogeneic RBC transfusion. In this multinational trial, 2,010 adults who were undergoing cardiac surgery with cardiopulmonary bypass were randomly assigned to receive acute normovolemic hemodilution involving the withdrawal of greater than or equal to 650 milliliters of whole blood with crystalloids replacement if needed, or usual care. In this trial, while acute normovolemic hemodilution was not associated with an increased risk of adverse events, it did not reduce the number of patients receiving allogeneic RBC transfusion. Resolution of squamous cell carcinoma by restoring T-cell receptor signaling by Peiyong Ye from the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland, and co-authors. Cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma is primarily caused by oncogenesis mediated by ultraviolet radiation. In this disease, it is believed that beta human papillomavirus, beta HPV, acts only as an early facilitator of the accumulation of ultraviolet-induced mutations in driver host oncogenes. In this report, the authors describe a woman with benign and malignant HPV-related diseases that include a recurrent, unresectable, invasive cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma with beta-HPV-19 genomic integration in the context of germline pathogenic mutations in ZAP70, an adapter required for T-cell receptor signal transduction. Restoration of the integrity of T-cell receptor signaling by allogeneic hematopoietic cell transplantation led to the resolution of all HPV-related diseases, thereby revealing a direct role of beta-HPV in skin carcinogenesis in hosts with defective adaptive T-cell responses. Motor vehicle crash prevention. A review article by Sheila Clower and Zachary Dorzoff from Virginia Tech Transportation Institute, Blacksburg. The human toll of motor vehicle-related deaths in the United States is staggering. More than 42,000 people lost their lives on U.S. roadways in 2021 alone. In addition, U.S. fatality rates, both per capita and per vehicle mile traveled, are much higher than those observed in many other high-income nations. In 2021, the U.S. Department of Transportation adopted the evidence-based safe system approach, which encompasses six principles. Death and serious injuries on our roadways are unacceptable. Humans make mistakes. Humans are vulnerable. Responsibility for safety is shared. Safety is proactive. And redundancy is crucial. The responsibility for roadway safety is shared by users, designers, operators, policymakers, administrators, and healthcare professionals. Measures to improve safety include interventions to prevent high-risk behavior by drivers and passengers, road design to reduce the risk of crashes, and to physically separate vehicles from pedestrians and cyclists. Manufacture of vehicles with enhanced preventive features and crashworthiness, enforcement of safer traffic speeds, and improvements to post-crash medical care. This review describes evidence-based strategies for moving toward a future with no traffic deaths. a 19-year-old woman with seizure-like activity and odd behaviors. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Judith Restrepo and colleagues. A 19-year-old woman was admitted to the hospital because of seizure, abnormal behavior, and disorganized thoughts. 10 days earlier, she developed slowed speech and intermittent right arm shaking. After collapsing on a subway platform, she experienced generalized shaking, confusion, and tongue biting, suggestive of a seizure. Imaging was normal, but elevated lactate levels were noted. During hospitalization, she had multiple episodes of fear, full body shaking, stuttering, and mutism. EEGs showed no epileptiform activity. Despite treatment with anti-epileptics, symptoms persisted, including incoherent speech, non-rhythmic jerks, and psychotic behavior. Autoimmune encephalitis, particularly anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis, was suspected due to the combination of psychiatric symptoms, seizures, and catatonia. Lumbar puncture revealed lymphocytic pleocytosis, and serum tested positive for anti-NMDA receptor antibodies. Imaging identified a large pelvic mass, later diagnosed as a malignant mixed germ cell tumor. Reform and remedy for imprecision and inequity. Ending the race-based evaluation of occupational pulmonary impairment. A Medicine and Society article by Rohan Kazanchi from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. In May 2025, federal regulations under Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act began requiring that all covered healthcare entities, including clinicians and health systems, demonstrate reasonable efforts to identify and mitigate discrimination caused by the use of patient care decision support tools. In the guidance underlying these regulations, the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, explicitly identifies adverse outcomes associated with the use of race-based equations for interpreting pulmonary function tests, PFTs. Race-based PFT guidelines were taught to clinicians for decades, even as questions arose about their validity and the implications of their use. Social scientists and historians were among the first to recognize that racial differences in measured lung capacity had been used as justification for the enslavement of Black people and for claims of racial hierarchy. Within medicine, a growing consensus gradually emerged that the field should end inaccurate and imprecise uses of race as a standalone proxy for biologic or genetic traits. Pursuant to a 2023 consensus statement from the American Thoracic Society and endorsed by the European Respiratory Society, healthcare systems have now begun shifting to the race-neutral Global Lung Function Initiative GLI PFT reference equation. But implementation gaps risk perpetuating inequities in disability compensation. Revised recommendations for COVID-19 vaccines, U.S. vaccination policy under threat. A perspective by Jason Schwartz from Yale School of Public Health, New Haven, Connecticut. On May 27th of this year, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced in a video statement posted on social media that COVID-19 vaccines had been removed from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended immunization schedules for healthy children and pregnant women. 3 days later, the CDC updated its recommendation materials, removing guidance that endorsed use of the vaccines during pregnancy and altering its language regarding healthy children from a recommendation for routine administration to a statement that the vaccine may be administered if desired by parents and informed by shared decision-making with their clinician. The CDC Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, the expert panel that typically develops vaccine recommendations, was not included in this work. And on June 9, Kennedy announced that all 17 members of the committee had been removed. These changes are the most recent developments in what has been an extraordinarily turbulent period for U.S. vaccination policy. Sustaining U.S. vaccination efforts in the current climate will be challenging, but approaches that emphasize the large, consistent body of science affirming vaccine safety and effectiveness, and that add credible, rigorous research findings to that evidence base, will provide the best opportunity for success, even if leadership and support for this work may now be needed from sources outside the federal government. Public Policies, Social Narratives, and Population Health, a perspective by Athindar Venkataramani from the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and co-authors. Public policies affect population health. Recent work suggests that if the entire United States adopted the policies of the states with the highest life expectancies, national life expectancy would increase by 2.5 years. Researchers and policymakers typically view these policy effects as accruing through changes in the availability of material resources and opportunities that protect and promote health. However, this view ignores the social context in which policies are generated and to which policies themselves contribute. Policies are tied to social narratives and norms that give rise to them, and policymaking itself is a tool for communicating or building these narratives and norms. For example, a prevalent social narrative in the United States is that of deservingness, the idea that people get what they deserve for the work they put in. This social narrative not only influences which policies are pursued, such as work requirements in social safety net programs or income transfers tied to work, but is reinforced by those very policy choices. A deeper understanding of social narratives and norms, mental models, policy making, and health may help explain current population health puzzles. Into the Valley of the Sick, a perspective by Sloan Weslow from the University of Pittsburgh. As a philosopher of medicine, Sloan studies the concept of disease. What makes something a disease? Sometimes her field ignores patients, even though being diseased often involves the experience of being a patient, of living with a disease, of undergoing treatment and care. Questions about the concept of disease can become detached from lived experience, as philosophical questions tend to do. But when we think about what makes something a disease, we are often asking what it means to be diseased. Who is sick and why? 6 years ago, Sloan was diagnosed with Cushing's disease. A tumor somewhere in her body causes the release of too much cortisol, leading to an array of symptoms: weight gain, high glucose levels, anxiety, weakness. Two operations failed to find the elusive source of excess cortisol, a tiny tumor somewhere. 2 years ago, she was fortunate to start taking a brand new drug that inhibits the release of cortisol in the body. So although a tiny tumor somewhere in her body tries to stimulate cortisol production, the drug blocks it. The drug was enormously successful. Sloan's symptoms and lab values normalized. But the drug had a conceptual side effect. As her symptoms waned during a 2-year remission, she started to straddle the line between someone who is diseased and someone who isn't. She was an imposter in the hospital, someone too healthy and too stable for this place. But she was an imposter outside it, too, someone living on the edge of the Valley of the Sick. Then her Cushing's returned in a new form, leading to different symptoms. In our images in clinical medicine, we feature spontaneous intracranial hypotension. A 50-year-old woman presented with a 10-day history of headache that worsened when she was upright and abated when she lay flat. An MRI of the brain showed diffuse pachymeningeal enhancement and tonsillar ectopia. Another image shows neovascularization in retinopathy of prematurity. A baby boy born at 25 weeks gestation was found to have retinopathy of prematurity, with spiderweb-like vessels covering the anterior lens capsule of each eye. Treatment began with an anti-vascular endothelial growth factor agent. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.